Welcome to another episode of the Reformation Roundtable podcast. My name is Joe Stout, and this podcast is a ministry of Christ Covenant Church in Centralia, Washington. During each episode, you will hear the sermons, liturgy, discussions, and interviews from the various weekly gatherings here at Christ Covenant Church. If you would like to find out more, please visit us online at ChristCovenantCentralia.com. Please enjoy the following audio.
For those of you guys who may have missed the sermon a couple weeks ago, we're starting into Mark 13, which is a hard chapter for many people. And so I want to use this time, actually. I have plenty of content here. I can talk about eschatology for hours and hours and hours. So I've got content here, but I really wanted to just spend time hearing what your questions are, and if I think some of those questions would be a good segue into the content, then we'll just get into it. But let's just have some open forum question time about eschatology. So you ask me anything. Andrew.
My understanding is the general position of our church holds to a post-millennial view on eschatology as general within the CREC. When I do some reading on the historical interpretations of it, it seems as though the post-millennial worldview of eschatology is a later adoption, and the oldest is a pre-mill view. So how do we reconcile that it is it seems to be a later held view by the patristics rather than a more an older view?
Yeah. So there's a few threads in there. First of all, just who's familiar with who knows what post-mill means versus pre-mill or a-mill? Just show of hands. So, I would argue that the claim that pre-mill is the earliest view is just false, because I just don't think that can be proved historically. And if anything, chiliasm, so C-H-I-L-I-A-S-M, which is another way of saying thousand in Greek. So chiliasm actually is condemned, which often is a form of, it is a form of literal premillennialism. So there were many heretics who, kind of like today, taught the world was going to end and thought they could calculate the end of the world. So it was a common view that the universe would go for 7,000 years, because, seven is the number of completion, 7 days of creation, or 6 days of creation, all that. So chiliasm was and is something that if you just search the church fathers or the medievals on this question, they will often just call it a heresy, because they were essentially trying to calculate and predict, here's the time when Christ is going to come. So I would argue that post-mill, pre-mill, and a-mill are just anachronistic terms that are probably not the best starting point for trying to assess your eschatology with the church fathers and the medievals. Because this is actually one of the places, if you guys all know the creed, the church has just agreed on the fact that Jesus is going to come back and judge the living and the dead. And then that's like creedal. So you can't, there's full preterists who believe that everything in Revelation, everything in the Bible has been completed, and this heresy has been revived as of late, thanks to the internet. So full preterism is a heresy. Partial preterism, which is my position, and like I said in the sermon, everyone's a futurist and preterist. It just depends on which text. when you read the best theologians, you'll see this is a place where they just don't agree. And they just recognize it could be this, it could be that. Here's what Augustine says. Here's what Chrysostom says. So the medievals are very important. So someone like a Thomas Aquinas is so important in the history of theology because he stands kind of at the turning point where the church fathers have been studying the Bible, hammering a bunch of stuff out. Christendom has actually come to a climax. So Christianity is just the religion. And the Reformation has not happened yet. So there hasn't been certain fractures in the church. So there's a more unified, authoritative sense of what the church has said on this question. And so there's certain things like Trinity is like a closed-handed issue, but it took some time to get there. Eschatology, up to modern day, is still an open-handed issue. So when you say, is our church post-mill? Well, no, not really. It's not in our confession. It's not in the creeds. It just happens to be what that's my position, and probably the rest of the elders. But someone could be pre-mill, someone could be a-mill, someone could just be undecided, and that's a lot of people.
Pan-mill.
Yeah, pan-mill. It all pan out. It's helpful to read the medievals on this question because you'll see them exegete like any of the Olivet Discourse passages. You can just look at all the different options and they'll say, yeah, this could refer to the destruction of Jerusalem. Oh, this could be second coming. This could be this other thing. It's a hard question because the word coming or parousia, or in Greek it's erchomai at times, just the idea of Christ coming can be said in like six different ways and is said in like six different ways just in the New Testament. So when you say Christ is coming or coming again, or he came or the second coming, you have to say, what kind of coming is it? Because we believe Christ comes to us when we pray the Lord's Prayer or when we come to the sacrament. So you always have to say, is it the literal bodily physical return of the Lord Jesus's of the Lord Jesus to the earth? And Acts 1:11 just says, he ascends into heaven, and the angels say, in like manner he shall return. So there's one of your kind of second coming proof texts, and there are others. But the vast majority of the New Testament, I would contend, is not talking about Christ's final coming, is how I would say it, but other kinds of comings in history. So to your question, the very first... Some of this is we just don't have a lot of commentaries on Revelation from the first 500 years of the church. They're few and far between. We do have a lot of commentaries on the Gospels. So you go to Matthew 24, because there's almost no commentaries on Mark, because if you're going to commentate on the Gospels, you almost always commentate on Matthew, because Mark is kind of just a much shorter version of Matthew, and Matthew allows you to do a lot more of the, you know, Sermon on the Mount. There's a lot more teaching. So when you look for commentaries on Mark, often they're just pulling from Matthew commentaries when you try to reference them. Does that get at some of your question there? That's a good one. Other questions about eschatology? Ben.
Would you hold that Romans 11 is yet future, or do you think that it's talking about something different?
Yep. Yeah, Romans 11. That's a very hard text. I've changed my mind on Romans 11 like three times over the course of my life. My current position is the position that James Jordan argues for, and you could just Google James Jordan Romans 11. For those of you who don't know, Romans 11 is Paul talking about Israel as the olive tree, and there are unfaithful branches that are cut out of the olive tree, and then Gentile wild olive tree branches are grafted in. And God talks about this grafting in of the Gentiles, and it says in there, "And in this way, all Israel will be saved." And then there's debate about what does all Israel mean in that passage. So some people, I'd say the dominant view in Christendom is that it speaks of a future to us in gathering of ethnic Jews. So they would, this is almost all dispensational pre-mill folks that think God still has a plan for what we would call Jews. And they would look at the existence of Israel today and Jews today and say, clearly God is still preserving them and has some dealings with them. And they would look to Romans 11. So even actually the Westminster divines held this view almost unanimously. Now, we don't subscribe to the Westminster Larger Catechism, just the confession, but in the Larger Catechism, one of the things it says to pray for is the ingathering of the Jews, and it's thinking of Romans 11. This is also Doug Wilson's position, who is my pastor, and I've interacted with him on this question, and it's an open question amongst post-mill, a-mill people. My position is that Romans 11 was fulfilled in the first century, and is what is described in the book of Revelation with the sealing of the 144,000. So when it's giving you 12,000 from this tribe, 12,000 from this tribe, I think it's describing the mass conversion of Jews to Christianity in the first century. And that is how the Jews who were scattered after the exile, so they're scattered all across the world, it's a myth that there are 10 lost tribes of Israel. That's just a myth. It's made up. In the New Testament, and you know this is a myth because in the New Testament you have the names of other tribes besides just the tribe of Judah named. So I believe Anna is from the tribe of Asher, and there's other tribes that are included. So I take Revelation, I believe it's 7 and also 14, as describing basically what Romans 11 is describing. And I think that what we call Jews today are going to be converted, but I think they're just another nation like all the other nations. But I'm not going to die on that hill. Good question. Josh.
A couple weeks ago when you preached, it seemed like your hinge text was, or the line was that all of this would take place within this generation. This generation will not pass away until all these things come, to fruition, basically. How do you answer those translations that would say, oh, well, you can translate generation as this race or these people?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have answers for that?
Yeah. So if you ask any actual Greek scholar, they will just tell you, you can't do it without violence to the text. This is where the Reformation was very great, was when Erasmus translated the New Testament from the Greek, and you got off of the Latin Vulgate. So my favorite theologian, Thomas Aquinas, only knew Latin, didn't know Greek, didn't know Hebrew, but was essentially the greatest theologian the church has ever seen. But he was using a Latin Bible. And so he made mistakes. And I think some of those mistakes, and a lot of the mistakes around justification are connected to, I believe, using the Vulgate and the way that it translates what we think of right. Our Bibles will say righteousness or justice, but it's the same Greek word that actually is underneath it. And if you look in Latin, it's just justitia. So there's, understandable errors or misunderstandings that have accrued in church history, because it'd be kind of like you just using your ESV or just your King James and not ever knowing what actually it's translating. So this is part of why, this is one of the major themes of the content I wrote, is if you think that every time the New Testament says world, it refers to the same thing, like this whole world and everyone on it, you're just going to get a lot wrong. Because there are like three different words that can be translated as world. And we even use world in English in different ways, right? And so you have a similar thing with otherwise really great church fathers trying to reckon with how can we make this happen within one generation. So they get created, this is what you do. This is the instinct of a good theologian. If you think this is saying something that clearly did not happen, then you should try to figure out, is there a symbolic way of understanding it? You should do that. That's what a good theologian does. And then they expect other good theologians to understand their intent and then say, look, here's the text they were working with. They didn't know and couldn't know how the Greek word that's translated as generation there is used in all of these other places. And it just, now that we have all of this, you know, you can go on your phone and find all of this stuff. Very few people even try to argue that anymore.
Actually, yeah. I'll question exactly what you just said about world, the whole world.
Yep.
I was curious because in Luke 21:35, it says that day, so referring to this coming of Christ, right? It says it will come upon, at least in the English translation, but listen. That they will come upon all those who live upon the whole face, or excuse me, on the face of the whole earth.
Yep.
It sounds like
yeah.
The entire earth.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And so it's referring to just the destruction of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're reading that.
Yep. So that's exactly the tension you should feel when you're reading just your English Bible, and I'm telling you this was all fulfilled in the first century. You're going, well, it says right here. That sounds pretty like comprehensive. So this is a major point that I'll be discussing this coming Sunday in the sermon, so I won't give that all away. But the short answer is world there refers to, this is the topic of my content tonight, what we would call, what the Bible refers to as the oikoumene. So there's another Greek word, but it's an important Greek word, and it's translated as world a bunch of times, but it refers specifically to the Greek Hellenistic, basically everywhere governed by Rome. And the content I have in front of me that we will definitely not get to, but we'll get to it maybe in 2 weeks, is an explanation of that oikoumene, because it's a God-ordained spiritual political order that Daniel 2 and Daniel 7 are describing. And the easiest proof text for this is that in Luke 2:1, when Caesar Augustus called for a census in the whole world. Same Greek word. It's referring to the oikoumene. So of all the times that oikoumene is used in the New Testament, the vast majority of them have this more limited sense of everywhere ruled around the Mediterranean by the Roman Empire, and then who before them? The Greeks, and who before them? Medo-Persia, and who before them? Babylon. And it's a whole regime that Daniel essentially sees in this vision and describes. So yeah, great question. And we'll do something similar probably in this session on like last days, because last days is another one of those really common phrases that refers to the last days of the Old Covenant, not to the last days at the end of history. But if you think last days, you think our last days, not their last days. Good. Desmond?
Abomination of desolation.
You're going to have a whole sermon on that on Sunday, so I won't, on Easter, so 3 Sundays from now. That's a fun one, that's a hard one, but I will address that. Good. Yeah, I don't think I'm even gonna try to get into my content. So let's just have more interaction, other questions.
I'd be curious to say more about that title, Son of Man, that you talked about a little bit. Mm. I don't know if that's over here, but
yeah.
We can talk about it later.
Okay. So who took me up and started reading Ezekiel?
I did.
Okay. So Thad, just tell us what, based on what you've read so far in Ezekiel, just what are your thoughts on what a son of man is, or how does Ezekiel help you, or is he helping you at all yet?
Well, I mean, I've always thought of Son of Man referring to Jesus. And when I talked to you last Sunday, it made me kind of rethink about that. But it seems to me more like a title mm-hmm. that is looking through certain people towards Jesus. Is kind of, but there's definitely, I'm only like in chapter 5 right now because I'm kind of reading it slowly.
Yeah.
I still get all that. There's a lot in there. That's about as far as I
know. Okay. So how many times would you say he's called Ezekiel, Son of Man, in 5 chapters? Has it? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is great. If you could probably do this on some internet search software, just type in Son of Man and see all the places it shows up, and you'll find it's in, you know, Psalm 8, it's in Daniel in like a couple places, but it's going to show up in Ezekiel like every chapter. So because most people have not read Ezekiel, they just think Son of Man is Jesus. And then when you hear about the coming of the Son of Man, you automatically think it's his bodily return at the end of history, which it is not. So I like to talk about the Son of Man. So this is a fun one. So who... let's just think about what a Son of Man is. So who is the first man? Adam. So who's the first Son of Man? Cain. And remember,
it makes that distinction in Genesis where it says, Adam, son of God, and Cain, son of Adam. I mean, I don't remember the wording, but there's a definite distinction between mm-hmm. Adam and his offspring.
So think it might help us to get our mind around Son of Man as a title by thinking also about Son of God. Because there's tons of sons of God in the Bible. Sometimes they're angels, sometimes they're people, sometimes they're rulers. And then, of course, we think, rightly, Jesus is the Son of God, but it's a dense concept. So let's think about Adam for a second. You guys probably already know that Adam is a kind of proto-priest in the Garden of Eden. So the charge to him to guard and keep, it's the same verbs that the priests are, the same task that the priests are given at the tabernacle. So Adam, what happens when Adam is kicked out of the garden? What does God replace Adam with?
Angel?
What were you saying, Aaron?
Are you talking about guarding it outside the gate?
Yeah. So God puts 2 cherubim to guard the way back into the holy place, which is what the Garden of Eden is. So it's a proto-temple. Adam is essentially the first high priest. So this is how you should think of Son of Man, is think of who Ezekiel was. So if you're just a Jew and someone comes along and says Son of Man, the first person you think of is Ezekiel. And who was Ezekiel? He was a priest and he was the high priest. That's basically you can prove that. One of the reasons you can prove that is because Ezekiel is not allowed to mourn when his wife dies. So God says, I'm going to take your wife from you, the woman whom you love, and you're not allowed to mourn. And when you read the law, it was just for the high priest, who is not allowed to defile himself because a dead body would defile you. So if you were a regular priest, you could do that, but he's not allowed to. He's also, at the beginning of Ezekiel, it says in the 30th year is when he starts receiving these visions, and if you track the chronology, his ministry ends in the 50th year. And also, when were priests ordained? At 30. And when did they retire or, you know, become elders? 50. So there's Ezekiel also is written in a very ornate style of 7 sevens. So if you go onto my local Christendom website and just type in Ezekiel, I think I did an overview of it, and I have the outline printed there. And you could see all of these sevens. And so what is it talking about? It's talking about the Jubilee. That's a Jubilee is seven times seven, and the 50th year is the year of Jubilee. And that's how the book of Ezekiel is like structured. It's playing with these sevens. And then, of course, what is Ezekiel doing at the end of the book? Well, he's in the temple, in the spirit, seeing a new temple, in this vision, measuring things, all of that. So you want to get Ezekiel, and especially like Ezekiel as high priest, in your mind when you think, when Jesus comes along and says, I'm the Son of Man. Because a Son of Man is a priest, especially a high priest, and also a prophet. And also, when does the Son of Man come? The Son of Man comes when God's glory has departed the temple, which is what Ezekiel sees in his vision, and he's the last prophet before judgment actually comes and destroys Jerusalem. So now what is Jesus doing in the Olivet Discourse? Well, he's the priest, he's the prophet, he's the Son of Man, he's Ezekiel. What does Ezekiel do in Ezekiel 43? He earlier in the book, and then he says in Ezekiel 43 that he's the one who destroyed the temple. So the Son of Man is a destroyer of the temple that comes at the end of the age when the abomination of desolation has been committed, and now a foreign nation is going to come be God instrument of judgment to actually desolate the place. So you can get that all just from the Old Testament, and then you're primed for when Jesus comes along and he's doing all the same stuff. So he is executing judgment and measuring the temple. He is inspecting it like a priest to see, is there mold on the walls? And if there is, it has to be torn down. So when Jesus gives that pronouncement, not one stone will be left upon another, that's just the priestly, that's the priest's job when they visit a house that has leprosy. So leprosy, of course, is just a symbol for uncleanness and idolatry. And Jesus goes and inspects the temple multiple times, and it's still idolatrous. They still need to be cleaned up. They haven't cleaned up. And so he just pronounces the priestly judgment. You got to tear it down. Not one stone will be left upon another. Yep.
So when Jesus declares himself Son of Man, that upsets the Jews because he is predicting the destruction of the temple. Is that, would they make that connection? That he's the high priest, the prophet that's coming, he's going to destroy the temple? Would that be a connection that they make?
It is one they could make. I think they're thinking more of the Daniel implication, because they're saying they recognized the Son of Man figure is like a quasi-divine figure. So, and that's the charge. He's calling himself God. So Son of Man also is a second Adam concept too. So you can bring in, there's the first Adam, who's the first priest, and now here's the last Adam. I'm mankind 2.0. That's what the Son of Man is. And then he allows... So Daniel is really interesting, because most people think that the Son of Man is Christ. And in a certain sense it is, but it's really referring also to the saints. So the saints are the Son of Man, and Christ is the Ancient of Days. And so the New Testament is playing with this idea when Jesus ascends and is enthroned as Son of Man. That is also signifying that the saints, who remember, were all down in Sheol, they're down in the ground. How do you get up to heaven? Christ has to come and resurrect the saints and bring them to heaven, which is what Revelation describes. And what the gospel describes when Jesus is resurrected, it says, you know, the saints came out of their tombs, that really odd phrase. And so part of the Son of Man's ascension is a prophecy of the Old Testament saints, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the patriarchs, ascending to heaven and then now reigning for 1,000 years, the millennium, until the final resurrection. So that takes us into Revelation 20. Excellent question, and keep going in Ezekiel and tell me. Ezekiel is one of the hardest books in the Bible, so I commend you for attempting to read it.